Hi everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Téngase Presente. For those of you who are joining us for the first time, this is a podcast on politics, economics, law, and philosophy from a classical liberal perspective, and usually with a focus on Argentina, since that's the country that I and most of the audience are from. Téngase Presente, by the way, means something like, let this be added to the record. And that's the spirit of the podcast. We want to show the world what classical liberalism has to say about current affairs through the people who represent it best. Since most of us are Spanish speakers, so far I've never conducted interviews in English. But I'm very glad to present this special episode with a fantastic guest, Deirdre McCloskey, an economist who got her degrees from Harvard and then taught at many American and European universities, and who specializes in economic history, and particularly, the study of classical liberalism and capitalism. Let's hear her out. So, Deirdre, first of all, thank you for accepting my invitation. As you're well aware, we are at the time of recording this episode, nearly 2 weeks away from November 3rd, when the US presidential election will take place. But the thing is, we're very used to hearing American politics being analyzed from one of two perspectives, either the Republican or the Democratic one. So what would be a classical liberal analysis of the two candidates, Donald Trump and Joe Biden, in terms of economic and non-economic liberties?
Well, Trump is, as we know, a very unusual person. He's a populist. And fortunately, he's not a very wise or competent or clever populist. If he was as smart as Erdogan or Putin, we'd be in deep trouble, because like them, he has authoritarian ambitions. So from the point of view of any freedom of Americans, it's very important that he not get a second term. Of course, there are a few things he's done that are good. I would not put his appointments to the Supreme Court in that category, which is what the Republicans think, but he has done some deregulation. But of course, he's done the deregulation often to help particular friends of his. He's extremely corrupt. So we're going to get Biden. I don't think there's any question that Biden is going to win by a large margin. It's the first time I voted for a Democrat since 1972. I don't vote for Republicans, but I always vote for the Libertarian Party. But of course, under the American way of counting the votes, only two parties have a chance. So we're going to get more Democratic Party expansion of the federal government. But it's not, I think, under Biden going to be a radical extension. It's going to be the slouch, you might call it, towards socialism that one sees all over the world. So I'm not horrified by Biden. I'm not thrilled. I wish it were a liberal. For example, he's not going to be as interested in free trade.
Well, neither is Trump, right?
No, and that's the point. Trump isn't either. And I'd rather have a kind of conventional Democratic policy of protecting this industry and that than the extremely erratic and high-handed way that Trump is operating. In fact, I just did a short piece for a German magazine making the point that although Biden has a primitive zero-sum view of foreign trade, Trump has an even worse one. He has sort of a mafia theory of trade, that trade is cheating all the way.
Right. So if you say you voted Libertarian in 2016, then why vote Democrat this time and not Libertarian?
Well, I'm an economist, and I understand very well that an individual vote does not count. It's completely irrational to think that one's vote matters for the outcome. There are millions and millions of votes. And indeed, I'm in a state, the state of Illinois, which is reliably Democratic even. So I just add to the pile of votes. But it matters to me personally as a sort of a, am I going to take seriously the danger to the public? So it's kind of my sacred duty is to vote against Trump. And the larger the sweep for Biden, the better. And I hope that, lots of Americans feel that way.
Right. So I think one of the main characteristics of contemporary American politics is that the two main parties are sort of deviating towards interventionist extremes, with Democrats fighting for an ever-increasing government interference in the economy and also other spheres, and Republicans vowing to continue with protectionism, immigration restrictions, the overturning of Roe v. Wade. So do you feel represented at all in the current political landscape?
No. Of course I don't. But, you know, as a classical liberal, I'm not on the standard right-left spectrum. From the point of view of a Democrat, I'm right-wing. But from the point of view of a conservative, the Republican who's against gay marriage and against abortion and so forth, I'm radical. I'm left-wing. And of course, we classical liberals want the government to be much smaller. We want it to be competent. We want it to fight forest fires and plagues early on for purposes of that character. If the Canadians invade, we want the government to leap forward. I can hardly sleep at night worrying about the Canadians. But we're not on the spectrum. We're kind of floating above the spectrum. Either side, the conservatives or the left, unfortunately in the United States, they're often called liberals, but I wanted to take back that word. They want big, powerful government in one way or another.
Right. So last week, we had a guest on the show that talked about how this election is, to him, a nightmare because people can choose to either be shot or stabbed, and neither of those options is obviously very good. And I wanted to ask you, given the current political climate, do you fear for the future of the United States, regardless of the result of the election?
No. I fear for the future if Trump gets, by some miracle, reelected. That'll be very bad. The outcome there is straightforward fascism. There is, in every country, I don't think it's peculiar to the United States, a quarter to a third of the population that's very eager to follow a man on a white horse, to go to the rallies and say, Sieg Heil. But the majority of Americans, and I think of most countries, are against this as they ought to be. And so if we get Biden, we'll get back a closer approximation to constitutional government. I think some of my libertarian friends are foolish about this. They believe that, you know, Biden is the road to serfdom, and soon we'll have a socialist governing of the economy. And although that's a long run danger, of course, it's not as present a danger as right wing populism is.
You were talking about the world too. So in a forthcoming article that you sent me, I read your statement that liberalism is under attack worldwide, which I'm assuming is a very bad thing, right?
Yes, it certainly is. But I think I'm optimistic the way Francis Fukuyama is. I believe in the long run, a free society is what people want and they will achieve. In fact, that the tyrants on the left and the right in Venezuela or with Russia have to use the police and even the army to suppress their own citizens does suggest, when you think about it, that they've lost the argument. And indeed, I think the American election is important here for the whole world, not just because if we don't get Trump again, we'll get more international cooperation on various things, but because if he falls, if Trump falls, that will demoralize at least the right-wing populists worldwide. And I think you'll find that the peak of right-wing populism will have occurred and it'll start to decline. So I think free societies are natural for humans.
That's a very interesting topic, actually, because I also read another forthcoming article by you in which you outlined the progress of your thinking over the decades. And one of the statements that struck me was, correct me if I'm wrong, that you eventually realized that liberalism explains the modern world and the great enrichment that the world has seen ever since the Industrial Revolution took place. But then you also say that the reason why that happened was a series of accidents. That is to say, there's no inherent value, virtue, or advantage that the Western civilization had over others. So the question that I have is, today, when we still have large portions of the world under poverty and cases where economic progress is being undone, as the history of my country, Argentina, shows, how can we advance progress and or stop the decline? Do we just need to wait for accidents to happen? Or is there some sort of formula that you would recommend that would lead towards liberalism and thus towards progress?
Well, we can certainly go on arguing and persuading people. We can go on preaching. But it's not true that the general tendency is for economic decline. On the contrary, economic growth in the world per capita is about 2% in real terms every year. And if that keeps up, as it seems to me that's rather obvious it's going to, unless we do very, very badly, we screw it up very badly, that's a factor of 8 in 100 years. So 8 times more goods and services for the average person in the world is a very great improvement. It'll mean the average person in the world in 100 years will have a higher income in real terms than people in the United States now. Now, of course, your own country is a peculiar example because, as you well know, as our Argentinians know, the Argentinians were among the richest people in the world 100 years ago. Yet, since Juan Perón, they keep slipping back, that is, the Argentinians do, into populist economic policies. I think, actually, it's a problem in Latin American politics generally. You see it happening in lots of Latin American countries, of this temptation to a combination of authoritarianism and populism. It's happening as we speak in Obrador in Mexico. And of course, it's already happened in Venezuela. But it's not hopeless. There has been economic growth in Latin America in the last half century. And in places like Chile, which have adopted liberalism, it's been fast.
And having studied economic history for almost your entire life, And regarding the question of progress at a global scale, do you think that economists are part of the problems that the world faces? Are they part of the solution, or do they not matter?
They certainly matter. As the hero of my college days, John Maynard Keynes, said, the world is governed basically by ideas. And that idea, that ideas are important, has become an extremely important part of my argument about the great enrichment since 1800, which is not about investment or exploitation, but is about the free market idea. And the implementation of that has enormously improved innovation. Instead of calling what we have capitalism, I want to call it innovism, because that's what makes, in the end, makes us rich. So it's... Look, behind the move to free trade since the Second World War are economists. A.C. Harberger, Alito, famous in Chile, used to say that all the salaries of all the economists in the world could be easily paid out of the gains from trade in advocating free trade. Essentially, the only advocates for true free trade are professional economists. On the other hand, there are economists on the left and some on the right who go the other way. In Latin America, Raul Rebisch was instrumental in advocating the notion of import substitution, which is to say rampant protectionism. So it can go either way. On the whole, in the last couple of centuries, economists like the original economist Adam Smith have been forces for good.
And, you know, one very interesting aspect that I see in you is that you haven't just studied economics or even economic history. You are, after all, a distinguished professor of economics, history, English, and communication at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And this is a pattern that I see in classical liberals, that in a world of increasing hyper-specialization, academics on our side tend to drive away from microscopic topics and instead usually embark upon interdisciplinary enterprises. And I feel like the concept of humanomics that I know you cherish points towards that direction. So how do you think this tendency improves both the study of liberalism and the recommendations that follow from it?
Well, I should mention Hayek in this connection. And before him at Chicago, Frank Knight, who are two instances of exactly what you say. As, again, many economists have said, including Keynes, you can't be a very good economist if you're only an economist. I think that if we here's one way to understand it. You can't do science, any science, astronomy, biology, history, economics, with just what you might think of as the middle bits, the quantification, the experiments, the observations. You have to have before it an understanding of the categories that interest you. What is a red giant? That is a question that humans ask. It's not written in the stars, so to speak, what a red giant is. It's our decision. And after we've measured the red giant so defined, there's a final stage of evaluation. So what? What does it matter that there is this category? And that, I've argued in the last 5 years or so, is the structure of any systematic science. So there's a humanistic part of science. It's the part of its art. And it's not just the art, that's how some people talk, but it's the philosophy, it's the history, it's the context, the human context of the science. So I think even from a strictly scientific point of view, a science is improved by thinking of it in this more broad way. But of course, it's particularly obvious with economics. Economics was properly called political economy, and that's what it is. If it's going to be something other than an aid to tyrants, we've got to put economics in this broader context. My friend Vernon Smith, the other Smith I call him, who's a Nobel Prize winner in economics, he always says, and his advice to young scholars is always, learn one thing in depth, in his case, experimental economics, but then read very broadly. And his advice is a practical example of in including a science within a broader human context. That's why his great colleague, Bart Wilson, at Chapman University, who is indeed a student of Vernon's, calls it humanomics. Economics with the humans left in. Now you still have the mathematics, you still have the experiments, you still have all the apparatus of a quantitative science, but you add an understanding of the human context.
Well, that's very interesting. But I'm running out of time, and to close, I would like to ask you a more personal question,
because
one of the reasons why I wanted to have you here on the podcast is that gender and sexual diversity are very important topics in terms of classical liberalism, and they have to do with an individual's very own perception and preferences. And in that regard, I wanted to ask you, since you transitioned from male to female back in the 90s, how your ideology either shaped or was shaped by this fundamental change in your life?
Well, it certainly goes in both directions. Freedom is freedom is freedom. Thank God I lived in a free society. If I lived in Saudi Arabia, I wouldn't have been able to do this and would have ended a very unhappy old man. But it also goes the other way, because being queer, to use the term, you become, as I wasn't when I was a guy, because I was a standard issue heterosexual man when I was a guy, you get much more sensitive to the proposition that freedom is freedom is freedom, that economic freedom, political freedom, social freedom, gender freedom are all a package. They're all the same thing. What a liberal society is, in one sentence, is a society without slaves. It's a society in which no one is physically coerced by anyone else. So that means that wives are not physically coerced by their husbands. It means that gays are not beaten up by the police. It means that ordinary citizens are not routinely coerced by the state. And it's that free society that we had when we were hunter-gatherers and lost when we became agriculturalists. Agricultural societies are hierarchical. And it's that we can free ourselves from, that hierarchy, and have been trying to free ourselves since the 18th century.
All right. Once again, thank you very much, Deirdre, for agreeing to this interview.
Okay. It's been interesting to speak to you. Be good. If you can't be good, be careful.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the interview. I particularly liked her sense of optimism towards the future, which is something that I usually see in other classical liberal economists, but is rarely found in those who are outside of our philosophical tradition. Rarely do people talk about the remarkable achievements that humankind has reached in the past two or three centuries, and yet those are astounding. The level of wealth that has been created, the number of liberties that have come to be respected in many countries, are things that I think we should cherish more than we usually do. Of course, there are many people who are not having a great time, and there's still a lot of room for improvement. But I think it wouldn't be bad if we, once in a while, stopped to reflect for 1 minute on just how extraordinary this interconnected, wealthy world is. Even more important is that we shouldn't stop the world from evolving, because the tendency is positive. We are building a better world every day, and that's also fantastic. But anyway, I would like to thank you for listening, and to those English speakers out there who might want to try Spanish episodes, please do subscribe to the podcast on Spotify, Apple, Google Podcasts, or whatever you get your podcast. You can also find me on Twitter as Hiperfalcon, that is HIPERFALCON, and I'll be waiting for you next Thursday, 7 p.m. Chicago time, with a new episode of Téngase Presente. Thanks for listening.